This is Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel.
Welcome back to Inside the Wolf's Den with your hosts, Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel. Today we have Duke Dodson with us. How are you, Duke?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
So great just to be here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a brief bio on Duke. So Duke Dodson founded Dodson Property Management in Richmond, Virginia in 2007. DPM grew to manage 3,500 single-family units, 2,200 multifamily units, 2.5 million square foot of commercial space, and 14,000 association doors. At its peak, DPM had 160 team members. In 2022, DPM decided to divest its single-family and HOA divisions to Evernest, based in Birmingham, Alabama, and its multifamily division to Atrium Management in Orlando, Florida. The remaining Dodson companies consist of commercial management, brokerage, maintenance, short-term rentals, and real estate development. Duke now sits on the board of Evernest and serves fractionally as VP of Strategic Growth, helping them locate and acquire single-family management companies throughout the country and as the CEO of remaining Dodson companies, whose vision is to be the driving force of the revitalization and stewardship of neighborhoods and communities in the Mid-Atlantic. Duke, again, thank you so much for joining us here today. We have a lot to unpack, but really I kind of want to take it back. Like, how did this all get started? You had massive growth and built this pretty incredible empire.
Well, thank you. No, it's funny. Somebody a long time ago said, just put your head down and just keep working. And that's kind of how I felt it kind of happened for us. I started the business in 07. And I was actually, before that, I was playing poker for a living, believe it or not.
Wow.
I was a young, just rambling young person. And I got engaged and I realized that my father-in-law and my wife-to-be and I all kind of decided that playing poker for a living wasn't going to be the thing to support the family. It wouldn't have been as steady as property management for sure. But so I started the business back then. I always knew as a kid I wanted to start a business, but in 07, the stars aligned. I was looking for a property manager, couldn't find one that I liked in Richmond, and thought, hey, maybe this, if there's a business to be started, this is the one that needs to be started. And I think I'd be good at it and I would enjoy it. And so, so I did. And then, like I said, you keep grinding and grinding and you look up and, 15 years has gone by. It's kind of crazy. It hasn't felt like 15 years. I'll tell you that.
So how did you do it through organic growth, or did you acquire other companies to really grow that and scale that quickly, or a combination?
For the first, I'd say 5 or 6 years, it was all just organic growth. I started the business, I had 3 rental properties. And so I was my own first customer. And so I set up the company to support myself and people like me. And so I just started networking with local investors, local realtors, trying to build a quality customer experience from the landlord point of view, and the tenant. But starting with what does a landlord want in a property management company? And I wasn't biased by working for 10 years in the industry for someone else. I had never worked in property management, so it was a block of clay. And I said, let's create the experience that investors, landlords want. And as we grew, we started looking at acquisition opportunities. And before we merged our group with Evernest, we bought 11 small businesses in Virginia and Florida. Mm.
Wow. What did you learn acquiring 11? I'm sure there's a lot of takeaways there, but maybe some highlight.
You learn something each time. You mess something up each time, and messing something up is the best kind of tool, best learning tool, because you don't want to have that pain again. So, what we learned is, we valued the business just like you would any business or even a piece of real estate. You're looking at projected income versus projected expense and what's left over to support your debt. We learned various different ways to go about buying the companies, through cash, through seller financing, through bank debt, combination thereof. We learned communication is just everything. Communication with the seller, communication with the new clients, the new tenants. Sometimes the teammates, if you're inheriting some employees, you cannot over communicate. When in doubt, communicate more with everybody. Make sure everyone's on the same page at the beginning. We established pretty good systems for notifying people about the changes. So we had, after the first one, we basically set up the schedule. We're going to tell clients this day, tenants this day, employees this day. Both sides are going to approve the communication. We're going to try to reach out not just with email and letter, but also through a personal phone call to each person. Little things like that really just help. You're still going to have fear. You're going to have anxiety. You're mm-hmm. going to have clients get angry. You're going to have tenants get angry. But if you can minimize that through communication, it makes it all work a little bit better.
That's awesome.
That's great. So what do you look for in an acquisition, whether it's locally or regionally?
We wanted to be, you know, obviously a product type that we manage, you know, a geography that we want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking like, you know, looking at single family specifically, you know, you guys go to the same conferences that I've gone to over the years, and you learn what are profitable units and what aren't. You know, we were never afraid to manage affordable housing or low end housing, but when you're buying, you're acquiring a company, it really helps if a lot of those,
mm-hmm.
those have a higher monthly rent, higher fee per door. You look at those metrics. But another day you look at, you know, you'll look at things like concentration risk. Like if you're buying a 100 unit company and one client has 20 units, for example, you need to make sure that either A, you make that person happy, or B, you're protected through some kind of clawback if they leave, or both.
Mm-hmm.
But in the day, we look at, you know, what do we think the revenue is going to be next year?
Right.
What do we think our expense load will be to manage those units? Do we have a good chance of keeping those clients and keeping them happy? And do we have a good chance of growing further? And can we kind of bank into our model some future growth in that market? And after you look at a bunch of them, you'll start to identify if this is a good business, maybe one you're willing to pay a little more for, or this is one that we should stay away from. And you just do that through trial and error.
Can you share something where maybe you totally just failed on it? Like it just didn't work out like you thought it would?
I think, it goes back to like communication. I think that we have found that when you're buying a business from a small business owner, one that their clients are used to dealing with that business owner, that person, you know, you call that person Tuesday at 7 p.m. and they answer, or Saturday at noon and that person answers. And if you have clients that are really used to that experience, it's really hard to duplicate that experience because, you know, I didn't want to take calls from everybody Tuesday night or Saturday at noon. I would do it for certain people, of course, but you couldn't build a business at scales where the owner of the business has to talk to everyone, right?
Mm-hmm. That's just
set up. So we learned that sometimes those bigger clients are not going to be happy with you ever. And that's why we kind of worked in clawbacks. And, you know, like we had several times where we bought a business and like 15% of it walked out the door on day one. Because of that concentration risk.
Yeah.
So we learned that that's a possibility. It might happen. So let's plan for it. Let's plan on first getting ahead of it and trying to communicate well to try to keep that person happy, but B, working out a plan where if that person left, you'd still be okay. And then second is like staff. Like you never know how the staff you inherit is going to interpret you as their new leader or manager. Sometimes it works out beautifully and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes just the differences in culture you can never overcome. And sometimes the employees you inherit are not going to work out for you. I mean, you can try as hard as you want to and just not going to work out. And so sometimes that's painful because mm-hmm. especially if it's a key person and they leave, all the other staff may have, you know, a relationship with them. A lot of the clients have a relationship with them, and that can be, you know, detrimental if they walk out the door and 30 or 40% of the clients really like that person. You know, that's sure. that's a negative that you have to work through.
Yeah. Now that you just kind of express, you know, company and culture, and I mean, it's incredible how you built this team, 166 team members at one time. Like, tell us how you did that. You know, I mean, just creating that company and culture.
Yeah. So like, you know, company culture became this buzzword about, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when it did, like we read a lot about it and we kind of got into that, like understanding what our culture was, what makes us unique, how you attract people to your culture, how you repel people from your culture. If that's what you want, if you mm-hmm. don't want them. And so we thought, you know, I don't think anyone is perfect at that.
Right.
And we thought we were pretty good at it. And so we, you know, we worked hard to establish a clear purpose, vision and values that basically define this is who we are. This is where we're going. These are the kind of people we're looking for. If you want to jump on this rocket ship with us, mm-hmm. come aboard. If you don't, that's okay. But we developed systems to look for those people, like, you know, through like behavioral questions in the interview process, through like employment branding to hopefully attract the right people from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And then once they're here, through just ongoing quarterly review process, you know, constantly seeking out, identifying, hey, you're fitting the culture because you're doing these things or you're not, and you're doing these things. And it needs a change or you're not going to work here anymore. And again, it's never perfect, right? Like when you're 166 people, I'm not going to lie to you and say they're all 166 were great culture fits, but I would say a lot of them were. And I think that was crucial for us to having a chance of success.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you a good, do you feel like you had the skill sets to be a good manager and build that size of business, or did you put people in place that were really good at, you know, because it's tough as you keep getting bigger and bigger and scaling that quickly to, I think Joni and I both had to learn, there were several points in our businesses where we had to step back and we had to grow as leaders, I think. And I'm just curious if you had those moments or maybe you just found great talent that maybe executed or you are that talented, which I think you are.
I think it certainly takes a different set of skills to grow from like 1 to 5 employees, then like 5 to 25, and then a different set of skills to go from 25 to 100. Mm-hmm. And I think as a leader, you're probably naturally good at some of those things, and some of the things you're not good at, you need to work at, or you need to, as you described, hire people that are good at certain things. So I think I was pretty good at the creation, the starting of the business, and I was good at getting up to kind of where we got to. I started identifying, as you hit those different hurdles, you really do need to examine your own skill set and realize what gaps you have. And do you plan to go through training and other exercises to get better at those gaps, or do you hire around it? And I think you could do both. And as we, leading up to this year, the mergers with Evernest and Atrium, like I started trying to be honest with myself and thinking, do I have what it takes to go from 150 employees to 1,000? And is that what I want? And I ultimately decided that's not what I wanted. I thoroughly enjoy the starting and the creating a lot more than like the running. And so I probably could have figured out the next 5 to 10 years. But I didn't, I just decided that's not what I wanted to do. So again, my value, I think, is in the creating and like the starting of things. And so I'm going to reposition my business in a way now where that will be a bigger part of what I do. And I certainly am not great at, like, we subscribe to the program called Traction. I don't know if you've
ever heard of it. Very involved. Yeah.
You're familiar with like, the visionary and the integrator rules.
Right.
Yep.
I'm better at the visionary. I can do the integrating and I've done it, but I don't enjoy it nearly as much. And so I certainly have to hire around things like accounting and HR, the integrator role. Those are the things that I'm not the best at that I certainly need help with.
Yeah.
Was it hard recently this year for you to let go and kind of merge, or were you ready?
Yeah, it was certainly bittersweet. There was some good and some bad. Ultimately, I will tell you this, and now that it's done, I'm certainly at peace with the decision, and it was the right thing for me to do. It's the right thing for the business. Matthew at Evernest will do an amazing job leading from here, like from now over the next 10 years there. And Mike Krause and Adam Wanis down at Atrium will do an amazing job leading the multifamily division. And I think that was what was best for the division itself, the employees, the clients, everything for the future. And it was also what was best for me personally because of the things I want to do moving forward. But yeah, was it easy? No. Was it emotional? Yes. Was a lot of anxiety? Yes.
Yeah.
Were there 90 days of like no sleep and like panic and worry about like, is this client going to be okay? Is this employee going to be okay? Did I do the right thing? All that. Yeah. All of that came along with it. But looking back on it now, a few months, after the dust has settled, I am 100% at peace with the decision, and it was the right thing.
Yeah. Is there any like major takeaways that now that you've gone through it that you would you should know going into something like that, or either sale or merger?
Yeah. We had done it 11 times from like this side, from the acquirer side, first time being the acquiree. I think the same things are true on both sides. Start with a position of trust. Like if you have a good relationship and trust with the other party, this case was Evernest and Atrium, but that solves a lot of problems. Like there's so many times when acquisitions can go bad. I mean, so many times. And if either party is dishonest or just not ethical, then it could turn really bad. In this case, I've known Matthew at Evernest and Mike and Adam at Atrium for 10 years, great relationship, a lot of mutual trust and respect. So when like we hit those like bumps in the road where something could have gone poorly, we communicated and we worked through it and it went well.
Yeah.
I would say communication's huge. I think you're never like, we tried our best to communicate with our people here at Dotson before, during, and after. I think most of them had a good experience, and most of them understood and appreciated it and are happy now in their new role at Evernest and Atrium. Some didn't like it, and you can't make everybody happy. And like, some of them wish we had done it. But I'd say for the most part, they now see why we did it, kind of setting them up for the future, giving them more opportunity for career growth, putting them in a position where their leader is focused on that division, that part of the business. They will see benefits from that versus me doing like 7 or 8 different things and a little attention here, a little attention there. I think one of your questions you're going to get into is the chase the shiny ball complex. And that is certainly something that I suffer from and I have to like be aware of. And it's fun for me, but it creates a lot of chaos and havoc for people around me. Mm-hmm. If they're not like set up for that's life. That's, if you work with me, like chaos is going to ensue because that's what I like to do. But if you're not set up for that, you don't like that, then chaos doesn't feel good. And so they are now in a place where their company is more focused on what they do, their core business. And so I think they'll be happy in the long run.
Yeah. Well, you're a true entrepreneur. We love chaos.
But not everybody else does. Yeah. We did hit a like a wall, I think, in the last couple of, I think part of it had to do with COVID and just managing all that, but where we were like, man, we can't, no more shiny objects or chasing that. Yeah, it was like, it can get exhausting at one point. But I had just a couple of questions with all that, and I'll answer them separately. So I'm just curious, why did you separate, and if you can disclose, the multifamily from the single family? Is that just what they specialize in, or I was just curious?
So I've been in a mastermind group with Matthew at Evernest and Mike and Adam at Atrium and a few other folks for the last 5 or 6 years. We all knew each other's businesses pretty intimately. My business, you know, at the time, Evernest was just a single family management company, and they added a brokerage arm and they do maintenance, right? But it's all single family, mm-hmm. They don't do anything else. Whereas I did single family, small multifamily, large multifamily, commercial, and HOA. And so we were kind of divided into those 5 management divisions. As we were growing, I realized each of those 5 things was becoming its own kind of monster. Mm-hmm. And each of those divisions needed a really good leader. And I couldn't be so dispersed over all these things and expect them all to do really well, right? Like, how am I going to compete with Matthew, compete with Pure, compete with Home River, if that's just one of those 5 things I do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if Andy at Home River's laser focused and Matthew's laser focused and Mike Kalana's laser focused, they're going to beat me. Like, it makes no sense that how I think I'm going to win that game if they're laser focused and I'm spread thin. So mm-hmm. I got to find, like, am I willing to be laser focused on one of those things? And the answer is no, I wasn't. So I said, okay, well, let's take these things, treat each of those 5 things like they're your children. And be like, let's send this one to this college and let's send this one to this college and make sure they're in a good place. And then, hey, pat them on the rear and say, it's up to you now. Go, go drive. And that way allowed me to do the things that I want to do. So we were already separated by division in that way. Matthew at Evernest had no desire to do big multifam. He wanted to focus on single fam. He was okay with a small multifam, what we call tweener, because it was pretty similar to single fam. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want anything. And he wanted to get into HOA. That was the next frontier for them. And we kind of provided that for them by just giving them an HOA division to start with. But they didn't want anything to do with commercial or multifam. Mm. So when that was going on, you know, I was telling my friends, Michael and Adam, about it. And we started talking about the multifamily division. You know, in Florida, in Orlando, they do single fam, multifamily development. And they're pretty passionate about growing the third party multifamily division. And as we were divesting of the things to Evernest, we now are realizing, look, we cannot afford all this infrastructure we've created for like 160 person company where we're going to get like cut more than in half. So I thought it made sense for us now was the time to merge multifamily with them, which gave them more scale, put mm-hmm. them in a good place to grow and thrive. And then it just decreased our company. So we're small again. So now we can kind of right size our leadership team. So now we're back to being right sized. It was just like relationships, time and place. And it was, it just felt like it was the right time to do all that stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Cause as we've watched you over the years and seen, mm-hmm. and I always like wonder, like, golly, how do you have this single family home division, this multifamily, this commercial? Cause I know you're active in actually acquisitions yourself and building and all. I'm like, and we have a building company and several other companies, but like when the property management space, we always suffered trying to get out of every time we tried to set our foot out into commercial or step out into, which we've done into multifamily, we just suck at it. You know, there's no other way to put it. We just were horrible and we just failed. And it's because our process, you know, we had built strong processes from, you know, like you said, the single family, mm-hmm. small multifamily stuff. And our people and our systems and everything was just built to run like that. But then you start tweaking it, or, and I'm just curious how you did that. And then maybe you grew it to a size where you said, no, I need a diversion. It sounds like a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of all that. I think, I do think that as entrepreneurs, you're naturally wired to want to create something, and then you work really hard at it and you have success. And then you're almost, it's almost like a false, false bravado that we get as entrepreneurs. Like, if I did that well, I could do that and I could do that. And eventually you spread yourself too thin and you realize that the first thing didn't work out just because you're like a magician. It worked out because you put a lot of energy and focus into it. Right. And then you can't spread that much focus over so many things. And I think it's a constant battle. I'll fight that till the day I die, is like the desire to start something new versus kind of nurture what's already there. And so, you know, one thing that we did do well, I thought, is once we kind of built single family and we built systems and created structure and process, you know, we, again, back to the program Traction, I'm not saying Traction is the best way to run your bit, but it's a way to run your business, and it's framework and structure. And that's the one that we subscribe to. So when we started a second thing, we tried to create the same structure within it. But it's hard to do that on the second or the third thing until you have scale in it, because scale allows you to have quality leadership and management. And if you can get to scale and then throw good management there that subscribes to your systems that you've created over here, you know, the way you set meetings, the way you plan for growth, the way you budget, the way you do all those things, create processes, all that, you know, that allowed us to keep our head on straight, as we had a good leader at each division, all subscribed to the same system, so we could talk the same language at our like weekly exec meetings and things like that. It's not perfect by any means, but that gave us a chance at success. But like, again, like each of those division heads were good, but like, what are they getting from me and the other parts of leadership? Are they getting enough time and attention and focus to really thrive? Yeah. You know, it all depends on what you think of success too, right? Like if some people are willing to have a small business in a market and it's small, but it's profitable and it's run well and they're fine with it. That's their goal. Like, my goals for all of those divisions were always grow. And some of them grew really fast and some of them didn't grow as fast. And so I wasn't okay with that. And I saw that as failure. Even if the division was running profitably, if it was just growing really small or poking along, I didn't see that as success. And so I was always like frustrated with it. And so I think that's another reason we led to, you know, this divesting decision this year, so that the things we do, we want to do them really well.
Yeah. Makes sense. You kind of touched on this a little bit already, but so something we've always struggled is building teams remotely or in multiple locations. Do you have any advice or found things that have worked for you?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do, and I don't think we're perfect at it. I think we have failed and we've succeeded. And what I did learn, going back to scale, like if we're talking like single, give you some real life examples. In single fam, we never had success in a different market until we had enough scale in that market to have like a 3-person team. So like for us, it meant like 250 or more units, enough revenue to support a 3-person team, and enough revenue to make the head of that 3-person team a quality leader that could manage the office and grow that market. And so for us, we learned, for us, don't start from scratch, start with at least 250 units. And make sure the revenue for those units is large enough to have a quality team. Now, the next question is, okay, well, how do you supervise them? How do you kind of incorporate them into your culture if they're remote? And again, we're not perfect at this, but basically we learned to try to get them involved as much as possible through Zoom, through face-to-face meetings, meet our staff meetings, going to there to have meetings, like just to get them as immersed in the culture as possible. I think, you know, COVID certainly was not a fun thing, but it did make us reliant on Zoom. And because of that, I think most organizations got better at communicating remotely. And then I would say before COVID, if all you did was Zoom with people, you might have felt secluded. But when we were in COVID, everybody's Zooming. So whether you're 5 miles away or 500 miles away, you're getting the same interaction. So it became normal, I think, to Zoom. And you can do a lot of cultural immersion through Zoom and slide decks and just meetings and communication. So, but it is hard. I know a lot of leaders struggle with that. A lot of leaders of businesses that are in one market and they go to market 2, 3, and 4, they're not getting the same cultural feel, yeah, the same growth, the same profitability. And that's in that secondary market. Cause like, think about like you're in your market. I mean, I've been in my market for 20 plus years. I've got 20 relationships, 20, that's 20 years of like referral sources, building and sending you stuff time and time again. And it's just, you can't recreate that, you know, overnight in a secondary market. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm just curious, because Richmond seems to have some like bigger players.
All of them are right there.
I'm like, how did you guys all end up in Richmond? But and we're friends with, you know, a lot of your competitors there, and so I'm just curious, like, how does that, do you guys play nice, do you guys want to crush the competition? Or I mean, because we're in a huge city, and you know, I feel like I don't hardly know very many people here in Houston, but like Richmond, there's some big players, and it's a little bit smaller of a market, so just curious.
I think all of our competitors here locally, we have a pretty good relationship with. I think we're all competitive. We want to win, but you don't have to win at the expense of your competitor.
Right.
You can, I mean, there's enough business to go around for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah.
A lot of the folks here, we network, go to Northam stuff together. Like I go to coffee with a lot of the guys that, you know, that we compete with. And we don't talk poorly about our competition. And for the most part, they don't talk poorly about us. We just try to explain, you know, what we're good at. And if you want to work with us, great. If not, that's okay too.
Yeah. Well, what I want to know is, what's Duke's next? Like, what are you looking to accomplish in the next 5 to 10
Your
years?
Your next shiny object.
Yeah. So like over the last, I'd say 7 or 8 years, like my big shiny object has been real estate development. More and more of my time had been pulled away to development. Like in towards the, you know, like beginning of this year, my time was like 50% management, 50% development.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing now is what's left of the Dotson companies is real estate development, short-term rental management, and then commercial management. And with that in that, you have commercial brokerage and maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone from being a 160 person company down to 20 people. Mm. The development arm is going to lead the way. And then what our new vision statement is to be the driving force in the revitalization and stewardship of neighborhoods and communities throughout the Mid-Atlantic. So what that means is like, we want to develop transitional neighborhoods. And we're doing that in Richmond, a couple neighborhoods, but also in a market called Colonial Beach, Virginia, which is a small market about an hour and 15 minutes northeast of Richmond on the river. It's a waterfront community.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a historic downtown. And so we're doing a lot of development there too. But we're going to develop properties in these neighborhoods. But at times, we're also going to invest in the businesses that rent the space in the developments of the neighborhoods we're developing. Mm-hmm. So what we have found in developing these kind of transitional neighborhoods is that the residential piece comes along pretty easily. If you build it, somebody will rent it or somebody will buy it. But the retail is what lags. Mm-hmm. And to make the development work, a lot of this like urban mixed use product, you have this, you know, retail component downstairs and apartments above.
Correct.
And that retail will sit empty 1, 2, 3 years as you're waiting for the neighborhood to come along. And so what we're actually doing is like we're front loading it by saying, okay, what do we want? What does the neighborhood want this to be?
Mm-hmm.
A coffee shop? Should it be a co-working space? Should it be a restaurant? Should it be a wine and cheese shop? Like what should it be? And if we can, if someone else will come along and rent it at market rates, make the deal work, great, let them do it. But if that's not going to happen, then we are actually, in some instances, we're creating the business that is going to inhabit the space, or mm-hmm. we're partnering with or investing in a business where maybe you have the entrepreneur, but they need funding or whatever. And so we are going sometimes own the business and own the building. And basically it's like, what you're doing is accelerating the development of that neighborhood, where it seems like a lot of risk, and it is, to invest in that business, which could go out of business tomorrow and leave yourself with some debt and a hole to fill in the building. But all the stuff around it appreciates faster when that quality restaurant comes to town, the quality mm-hmm. coffee shop, the quality co-working space. We've done that, you know, we didn't call it that, but over the years, I'm part owner of a co-working space called Gather, which has 7 locations in Richmond and Virginia Beach. And we, in 2 neighborhoods, Scott's Addition and the Arts District, we did a pretty large scale development, and we were the anchor tenant. Like Gather was the anchor tenant, and it worked out pretty well there. We saw what a co-working space can do for a neighborhood. Everybody knows coffee shops or, you know, help neighborhoods come along. And there's other businesses that do that too. So long way of saying we're gonna develop neighborhoods, we're gonna invest in those businesses, and we're going to own the business and the real estate at times. And then as the market develops, it's very possible we take that business and move it to the next developing neighborhood, and we let the market rent that space at market rate. Because I'm going to give you one example. Scott's Addition is probably like the biggest success story in Richmond as far as real estate development goes. The neighborhood went from nothing to becoming the best neighborhood in Richmond as far as retail rents, apartment rents, everything. Mm-hmm. It happened pretty fast, like the course of 5 to 7 years. We got in early in the neighborhood and we put Gather in as a commercial tenant in one of our first projects. And Gather was paying $13 a foot in rent, triple net, and no one else would pay that at the time. So we had to fill that space and make the deal happen. Because we did that deal, we did two more beside it, and then other people did deals around us, and next thing you know, the neighborhood's fine. But if Gather were to move out today, we could rent that space for $25 a foot all day. It's only been 5 years. So,
Is that like down there by the university, or is that?
It's about 3 miles west of VCU University.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
I think you're giving back, right? And contributing, and yeah, so that's awesome for your next. I mean, where do you think the real estate market's going now that you're getting into, you know, development and all that? Obviously, sometimes more risk. Where do you see the market headed in over the next couple of years?
Well, it's certainly a little scary at times, really, because the interest rates construction costs are up, and they've been up, and that is what it is. You know, rents have been growing fast enough to counteract the construction costs component. Mm-hmm. What is this interest rate increase going to do? How long will it be here? How long will it hurt? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I would say, like in Richmond and in most markets, what is working in its favor is simply supply and demand of humans versus beds, right? Like you've got more humans than you have beds in a lot of these markets. And so it's not like it's going to zero overnight for those like income producing real estate. Like if you look at real estate you already own, am I worried about people paying rent? No. Am I worried about them paying a big number in rent because now inflation has kicked in and now 1700 is the new 1400 as far as rent? So like I'm not that worried about stuff we already own and manage. Is it going to kill some deals, stall some deals on the development side? Yes. But what happens then if a lot of deals stall, then there's less supply of housing and the demand is still there. So then like rents go up a little bit more probably to, cause there's more people fighting over less housing.
Right.
So like I would say the projects we're looking at right now, it's very hard to make the numbers work because of interest rates. Very hard. So in our world, that means we might have to take on less leverage and more equity. And then the equity is going to get less of an initial return because you're putting maybe 30% into a deal as opposed to 25% equity. Mm-hmm. And so as long as we can find patient equity to take, you know, get a lesser cash on cash return for the first couple of years. And then year three, year five, year seven, whatever, maybe rates drop, you can refinance and pull some cash back out and it'll all work out in the long run. But like, it's still really hard. If you look at somebody buying a house and they were going to pay 3%, now they're going to pay 6 or more. I mean, what in the world, what do they do? I don't know. So I'd say it's a little scary, but I'm not that scared.
Yeah.
Good point. So one last question. So if you were just starting out and could go back in your early 20s, what advice would you give yourself?
That's a good question. I think that's the one question that you gave me. I wasn't really fully prepared for it. I think for the most part.
You're like, still young, dude. What are you talking
about?
That
was like 5 years ago, right?
For the most part, I wouldn't change much. Like, I think starting any kind of business, I think you're a bit young and naive. And I think some of that's good and some of that's bad. I think it's, if you knew how hard it was going to be, maybe you never would have done it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of glad I didn't know how hard I would have to work and how hard it would be. I'm scared to do about that. There's a lot of easier ways to make a living than starting a business.
But I don't think it'll
change much. I think I may, you know, back to the shiny ball complex, is I may have said, instead of starting 5, 6, or 7 things, just do one for a while and then do two. You know, like, I think the tendency to jump into new things is fun and exciting, but it also can cause some damage. And so if anything I would change, it might be that is you don't have to create everything. Just focus really hard with the one thing you're doing and then maybe later do the second thing. But if I gave myself that advice, I probably wouldn't listen to it. So.
Well, good advice for those that are starting, you know, as an entrepreneur. So thanks.
So how can, if people want to reach out to you, maybe they're in the Richmond area or looking to invest or maybe one of those passive investors for your next project, how can people reach out and get a hold of you?
Yeah, so our main page is dotsonpm.com. It's like our traffic hop page, which kind of routes you to the different sites. If you're an investor looking in like development deals, our website there is dotsondev.com. And then I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn and like Facebook and Instagram and everywhere. Email is duke@dotsonprop.com. And you always love chatting with folks who are anywhere in the whole real estate space, whether you're an investor, landlord, you want to start a business, like any of those folks that we would love to chat with, because there's a lot of people we can partner with to do a lot of things. So we'd love to chat.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Duke, for joining us today. It's been a great episode, and looking forward to our listeners to listen to this.
Yeah, so if there's anything we can ever do for you, please let us know. But we really appreciate your time today, and I think you added a ton of value, and so it was good. And you answered a lot of my questions, so some of those were sprinkled in, some of our own questions, so thank you. And
thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. So if you like this episode, please share it. Please rate it. We depend on your reviews and ratings. And otherwise, we'll see you all next week.
See ya.
You've been listening to Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkle. Tons of entrepreneurial podcasts are out there talking.
Talking.
But Joni and Sean are living it every single day. Their portfolio now includes many franchises and medium-sized businesses. We talk about the trials and motivators of successfully running a business. Join us again soon for another podcast. But until then, reach out on the website at InsideTheWolfsDen.com, on Facebook at Inside the Wolf's Den, on Instagram at Inside the Wolf Den. We'll see you again soon. This is Inside the Wolf's Den. We'll see you next time.